Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
No holds barred. Hi, Emily. How are you doing?
Good, thank you. And yourself?
Really good. Well, really hungover. As we recorded, England had just beaten Denmark, and obviously it's coming home, so we had to celebrate that, and we did with gusto, and now I'm really feeling it today. This is the worst hangover I've had in a long, long time. But
God.
You okay? You recovered from the game?
Yeah, very well. I didn't get too drunk last night. I had a couple of glasses, and then by that point I was too nervous to even think about drinking, so I left it as that, which I'm really pleased about, but Sunday might be a bit different.
Yeah, for sure. Let's get into it then. Why did you want to become a nurse, I guess, for best place to start?
Do you know what? I'm not too sure on that answer. I suppose it's just in me. It has to be in you to be a nurse. We certainly don't do it for the money. Mm. I just have always had that in me to do care work or a care in nature, I suppose. And I have always just wanted to be a nurse since I can remember. But it was the way I was going to go about it that was so the interesting bit, I suppose.
Typically, what do you do? You study, you go to, is it nurse school?
It's a university.
Right.
So I left school with average GCSEs. I was a straight kind of C student. And then I went on to college and did a social care or a social studies course to then access to nursing, really. At that point, something got in my way and I just wanted to join the army. So I kind of just looked at options of how I could do it while doing that.
So you wanted to join the army. Like, what drive? I don't know, really understand what drives anybody to want to join the army. I get there in young men, if you're going sort of stereotypical, you know, that you play army, don't you? You play guns, you do that sort of stuff. But the reality of what some people have to do and the lives that people in the army might have to live from someone who doesn't really understand it seems so much more serious. So how old was you then when you thought, right, I'm going to join the army? How old was you?
I suppose when I went to college, I was about 16. And then I just started the ball rolling, really. I just decided, but it started while I was at secondary school. And one of my design technology teachers said, Emily, I'm sending you on something called a look at life course. And he picked me out of the whole year. And I was like, why are you sending me? And he was just like, I just think you would be really good for it. So it's a 5-day course. It was like in the local area. You'll be shown like what it's like to be a soldier. You'll go out on exercise and you'll do different things. And then you can pick a friend, and we did, and we went, and we did like all the exercise, and I think we stayed out at night in a what we call a bivvy or a tent that we'd made, and had to eat and cook our own dinner and things. And I just loved it. Mm. I loved the concept of it. I loved I don't know why, I can't answer why, but it was forever in my head. So at 15, and also my granddad was in the army, and my mum travelled, she was born in Germany, and I had that kind of, he was really proud, and I just had that background, but that was it, there was nothing else, it was just that. And as soon as I got it in my head that I wanted it yesterday and I was going to do everything in my power to get in, really, as soon as I could. So at 17.
You like 17 then, yeah.
Yeah. I went to the careers office and started doing all my, you have to do lots of tests and things. And then it got to the point where I was accepted to go in, but because I was only 17, my mum and dad had to sign me in. So I went to my mum and said, oh, this is what I want to do. And she was like, I can't do it. I can't sign you into the army. That's like the crazy, I'm signing you away.
I was going to ask. Yeah. How did they, when you decided at 17 that you was going to join the army, what did your mum say? She's like, I can't sign you off and send you off. What did you do?
She was really like, although she knew it was probably the best thing for me, not that I was wayward, but I was kind of, I was a bit old before my years. I really wanted to just go, and I was just ready to go and fly the nest. And then my dad managed to persuade her and said, she is so untidy, they literally will have her for a couple of weeks and then they'll want to get rid of her. So, like, let's just do it. And if we don't, she'll, you know, she's only going to do it in 6 months when she's 18. So, yeah, they did. And they took me to Lichfield where I did my basic training. Just trying to think of the years. It must have been 2004. I think it was 2004, yeah, that I got dropped off at Lichfield and with my suitcase and marched into the camp.
At 17, that's like you're about as young as you possibly can be. Also female, which I can't imagine the. So you went, when you said you went basic training, is this the first thing that everybody does when they go into the army?
Yeah, so you have to do 12 weeks basic training, and that's to make you a soldier, basically. It's nothing to do with whatever path you decided to do. Like, I joined... Lichfield was home to the signals and the engineers, and there was no QAs. So when I talk about QAs, that's the nursing corps. And yeah. there was none. It was just, I think it was five of us that got put into Lichfield to train with the engineers and the signals. And we just do your 12 weeks basic training to make you a soldier.
What's a signal?
Signals are, the signal regiment are like, they do all the radios and things, and telecoms, I think. And then engineers do all like the building. And then, you know, like if you go on exercise, they'll build a bridge. Say you need a bridge, they'll build it, kind of thing. Wow. So,
and you was one of, how many girls were in this induction? And what was the sort of age range of the people?
Yeah, so there was five girls, so five QAs that rocked up at Lichfield. And I remember one girl was from, I think she was from like the Caribbean islands.
Mm-hmm.
One was younger than me, maybe like 17, 16 and a half, 17. Right. And another one was Irish. And I think the other one didn't last basic training. She kind of went... she didn't do the whole lot, so yeah, that's, and then the rest were pretty much all boys or some girls. You get girls in the signals. So
what's basic training entail? Is it what you think, you know, bags marching across rough terrain? Is it holding a gun correctly? What is it, marching?
Yeah, so it's everything that you've just said, really. It's I think the first few weeks it's the basic things of getting your kit packed and knowing how to use it. You get a weapon, an SA-80 is what we got when I was in, pretty much straight away. But it's obviously kept in the armoury.
Yeah.
You go and sign it out and things, and you go on the range to do weapon training.
And are you carrying this gun around and it's live? It's loaded, sorry.
So only when you're on the range. When you don't get a magazine or anything until you're on the range. And then you get given your rounds to put in the magazine, and then you'll get like 10 rounds to shoot in different positions at different lengths. So you might do at 25 meters, 100 meters. So yeah, only when you're on the range. But
was you any good?
The rest of the time, pardon?
Were you any good at shooting?
Well, this, yeah, it's quite funny, actually. So I wasn't great at shooting, and no one could work out why. And it turned out that I can't close my left eye as well as keeping my right eye open. This stems from childhood. I remember my brothers were like, why? You know, when you back in the day when you looked through a camera to take a photo.
Yeah.
I could never do it. So it stems from that. So in the end, they had to give me an eye patch, which was so embarrassing. because I had to put that on every time I went to the range. But I, yeah, once I had that on, I was really good at, well, I was quite good at shooting anyway. So I wouldn't say amazing, but, you know, I managed to get the target.
So everybody, regardless of what their role is in the army, they need basic training and you need to pass that in order to get on to do what you want to do.
Yeah, definitely. So I did a few weeks and then I got back trooped. So I became injured with what they call shin splints, which is quite a common thing in the army. So
quite painful,
I was really fortunate. Pardon? It's
quite painful.
Yeah, but I was really fortunate. I've got really high insteps. And so they fought for me, really, the physios, to get boots made for me, because that's the cause of why I was getting them. So I just waited in like a troop for injured recruits while my boots got made. So as soon as my boots got made, I went back into training.
Well, could you have been removed from that injury?
Yeah, you could be medically discharged and then that would be your kind of army life over.
Really?
Yeah. Well, that happened to loads of people.
You couldn't come back?
Not really, no. I don't, it would be really difficult if you, well, once you're medically discharged, that reason. I don't know of anyone that's gone back after being medically discharged.
So why did they do that for you and not for other people?
Maybe because they could see that I couldn't do anything about the high arches and they were just like, let's give it a go. I mean, they weren't really expensive to have them made, but it was definitely a novelty. Not many people got boots made for them, so I was really fortunate.
So you've done your 12 weeks, you passed, you got over this injury, and then what happens next? How did you start training to become a nurse? Where did you do that and for how long?
Yeah, so you get posted. So once you finish basic training, you get posted to your different regiments. But because I needed to do some training, because I was only 17, I wasn't able to go ahead and do my nurse training. I was talked into becoming a healthcare assistant, which is the a nursing assistant, basically, but you have to do training for it. It's not as intense as nurse training. There's no real exams or anything. You undertake an MVQ, but it was my road to getting onto nursing, really. Mm. And with being so young, they recommended that I did it for experience. And I'm really pleased that I did, because it set me in good stead for my nurse training, for sure. But I went to Gosport. Near Portsmouth.
Yeah.
So that was, I think I was just 18. Yeah, I think I had my 18th birthday in the April and I was in Gosport by the August.
So are you living in barracks while you study? What is it? Or are you just at home?
No, you're in barracks. So you are in rooms, basically.
What do you share with other people or?
I did when I was in Gosport. I think there was two or three of us in a room in Gosport. You normally get a wardrobe, a sink sometimes in your room, and then you share your showers and bathroom with like a whole corridor, different other students or soldiers. And then you have a cookhouse, they make all your food for you, and it's like a buffet, kind of hot buffet that you just go and pick what you want, get fed three times a day. That's basically what, and we weren't there long. We were only there for about 6 weeks in Gosport. And then from Gosport, we then get posted. So I got posted to Frimley Park Hospital in Surrey. I think it comes under Surrey, or Hampshire actually. I was there. So we back in the day, we used to have loads of military hospitals, but they were too expensive to keep, basically. So the government or the armed force decided to do Ministry of Defence Hospital Unit. So we'd have like a an office within a hospital that was all military. So you'd have military clerks, military bosses. And then on the wards, you'd work with civilian nurses, civilian doctors, but also army doctors, army nurses. So we'd all mix and we'd have a mix of civilian patients and army, navy or RAF patients.
These would have been people that have been injured abroad or in exercise?
No, just general. So I was on the orthopaedic ward. So if someone needed, they'd fractured their leg or they'd, I don't know, something like that. If they were a soldier, they'd come on to our ward. If they were a civilian, they'd come on to our ward.
Yeah. What is the training that you get if you're in the armed forces as a nurse different to what you'd get in a normal hospital or university when you where you would study typical nursing? And the reason why I ask that is because what you're likely to be confronted with moving forward as you go into the army is the different challenge to what you might see in an A&E, although but perhaps not, I don't know if that's the correct thing.
So I'd say because I joined as a healthcare assistant, my training was probably a bit more in-depth, like we were made to do MVQs. If you joined as a healthcare assistant in a hospital, you wouldn't necessarily be, it would be on-the-job kind of training. Nurse training, though, is no, it's exactly the same as civilian training. You still have to upkeep your soldier duty, so you still have to go and do the range once a year and shooting, or you'd have to go and do like an assault course and things like that. So alongside your nurse training, but then it's that you have to do the degree the same as what a civilian nurse would do. The difference would be is exercise. So you would then once you're trained, you'd then if you were being deployed, or not even if you were being deployed, even just as an exercise, you would go to like a tent. They'd do like they build it, and then you'd go and practice. So you'd have people that were actors playing casualties. So you'd have people who were paraplegics, or they'd had amputated legs, and they pretend to be soldiers.
Or, so actors, actors.
Yeah, actors.
So that's what I guess I'm asking. Yeah, is like how did they prepare you for what you might go on to see? Should you be deployed in a war zone or where you were eventually deployed in Afghanistan? What did they do to prepare you for that?
So before I went to Afghanistan, I was we went to North Allerton in Yorkshire and did a pre-deployment training. So it was like a purpose-built, I think it was in a tent actually. So they built it, because Afghanistan was becoming, I was quite early in Afghanistan, but because we'd already had people out there, that was basically where everybody went who was doing their training or going, getting deployed to Afghanistan.
They went to North Allerton first.
They'd go to, to North Allerton or different. There was quite a few around the country. And that's where the actors would go. They would give scenarios of maybe what's already happened, but what we would do, how we would like what we would do in that situation basically. And they would you'd get assessed, so people would be assessing you. It was though it was, we knew it was kind of actors and role play, it felt intense real. And quite real.
So you would go into a tent, they'd milk it up to make it look like the medical tents that would be in Afghanistan, so that everything is as real as possible. And would they use, for the wounds that you were tending, like you said, like what did you say, legs?
Yes, amputees. People who've already got amputated legs or arms, they then kind of, you know, put fake blood on there and pretend, like they would just pretend that their legs been blown off, and what would we do then?
So they would make use makeup and stuff. Actually, well, this just popped into my head, and it's something no one in my family knows the answer to. But my great uncle, Uncle Bill, he was in the Normandy landings, and the shell came over and exploded, and the shrapnel went through his leg and into his leg, and eventually he would have. he would have been, we don't know at what point his leg was amputated, or was it, did it happen? They would have, if I guess what I'm asking is, if you're confronted with, what would your process be if you approach someone like my uncle Bill?
Yeah, the process would be, so we all get issued, not so much us, but if you're a medic that was going out with the kinds of infantry or the battalions out on the front line, you'd get issued a tourniquet, which you, if you knew, like, obviously someone's got their legs kind of been blown off, then basically you cut that blood supply off to below knee or above knee, wherever you can do it. And either they can save it when they get to, it depends how quickly they get them to hospital, but if they can't, then you've saved that person because you've put the tourniquet on. And it's only their leg that you haven't saved, but you know, that's probably the least of someone's problems when they've
gone through that. He's was amputated. He basically had no leg. He had it was really high up. I remember it because we used to knock on the prosthetic when we were kids. He'd go, come and check this out. It was like, not really appreciating how horrific a thing he went through. But it was quite up. So you're in this tent and you're going through this process. And what are they training you on the most likely things that you'll have to treat? Like, would it be gunshot wounds? Would it be, like you said, like a damage from explosions, burns, that kind of thing?
Definitely. I'd say they were training us on worst case scenarios. Yeah. Like,
did it not but scare then saying you?
Say that again.
Did it not scare you? It scares me. And
it scared me now at 35, but I had no fear at 17, really. You know, I didn't grasp. Even now I look back and I think, oh my god, then the things, like, I did all that, and it sometimes doesn't feel that, because it's so quite a long time ago, it feels like a completely different life. I don't think I did feel fear. I don't remember it. I only ever felt like pride and excitement, and that's what I was trained to do. I wanted to go out and do it. You'd see all your friends get posted and you'd be like, Iraq had just happened, and I never got posted to Iraq, so I was always a bit like,
you were desperate to go.
Definitely. Wow. There was absolutely, you know, you did get a sense of like, why aren't I going? You know, I didn't have a family then, I didn't have, you know, that kind of lifestyle. I was on my own. I was living away from home, and that's what I joined to do, I suppose. Yeah,
that's mad. Do you know how mad that sounds? From
it
my
does, but
to listen
it
to.
Does sound mad.
Iraq. Send me to Afghanistan. You spent 4 years. No, so it was 3 years that went at training before you was eventually deployed. Have I got that wrong?
Yes. So I was 2004, I think it was 2006, we went to on Herrick 5. So in 2006, the October 2006 to the April 2007. And then, but in that time, I was working on the wards and doing like a soldier kind of duties and things, but pretty much just working as a normal healthcare assistant, nurse in the NHS.
And then, so at that point, the war's quite far away, I guess, isn't it? It's still, you know, it's happening, but for your mum and your dad, and you're well in there by now, and they must have been concerned that you would eventually get deployed to Afghanistan. Was it inevitable that you was going to go there, or?
Definitely, either Iraq or Afghanistan, because they were both going on at the same time as what I was in the army, and they were both quite. Well, Afghanistan certainly was just kind of starting by the time I joined.
Yeah. And so what was their reaction when, like, you was excited, as you said, but what was your mum and dad's reaction when you said, right, I'm going to Afghanistan?
I don't really remember, if I'm honest, because I lived away. So by this point, I was living in Aldershot, and I had kind of got my own life in the sense that I wasn't one that went home every other weekend. Because we worked in the NHS, I had to do loads of shift work. And so I just, my life was really very much like my soldier friends and being in Aldershot. So I think they were quite used to me being away and that it wasn't a...
Would your mum have been worried about your safety, do you think?
Yeah, of course they were definitely but worried, of course they were, but I think for them, knowing that I was not going to go out on the front line, I was within Camp Bastion and I pretty much stayed there. There was a couple of times we went out, but only to do the range, not any kind of tasks or anything like that. It was literally just in Camp Bastion. So I think they would have probably felt a bit different if I was having to drive through Afghanistan and things, but I didn't.
Camp Bastion is essentially a camp, but in the desert. It looks pretty grim. I'm just looking at pictures. Like, the views are not that nice.
No, it's very sandy.
Was it hot, I bet?
It wasn't actually. When we got there in October, it was quite hot still. But then by Christmas, New Year, it could get really cold and windy and didn't get loads of rain. But when you did, it was horrendous, like rain. And I remember the thunderstorms, the thunder was like epic. It was like you'd never seen before. But then come kind of February, it was boiling hot again. Very hot.
Is there things that the public know, like when they think about Afghanistan and the way it was reported, that you just think is incorrect? Like, you know, there was an idea that at a time when the tabloids were just full of sort of soldiers bullying and mistreating, and that obviously you're going to hear about that stuff, and it's actually I think the stuff in the Mirror has actually proven to be fabricated anyway, but are there things that are frustrating for somebody who's been in the army to hear, or
of course, definitely, because you know there was so much good, I'd say, that we were doing out there, but yeah, it was because we saw the soldiers, they, you know, they'd be in really awful conditions in like outposts, like Lashkar Gah and Sangin and where the real intense fighting was happening. And they, you know, they'd come back and you could just see it was morale was low, because they, you know, they weren't getting anything out there. You know, for me, I was in a big camp, which was quite established. But you know, they weren't even getting mail at times. You couldn't speak to people. We didn't have mobile phones. There was nothing like that. Facebook, I don't even think Facebook had just kind of started communication. It was really limited. And yeah, it was just intense fighting all the time for them.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I think they were.
Would it be mental health?
Yeah, definitely. That was probably the biggest for them, for sure.
As a nurse, would you help? How could you help them with that? What would the process be? And what was you doing if you was helping them with mental health? But what was you... What was you doing? What was your day-to-day like in Camp Bastion?
So day-to-day, it was basically we would do shift patterns. So we'd do like a late, early night, and then you'd get a day off. I say day off, you don't always get it, but that was like your sleep-in kind of day. And it was very much so we had two wards, and then one we tried to keep as like surgical, one medical, but it never kind of worked like that. It was always a bit of a mix of everything.
Because it's impossible to plan for, or why would
it? Yeah, I would say from what I remember, it was just quite difficult with what we got. Sometimes we'd get Taliban on the ward, we'd get soldiers, we'd have, so you had to be careful because you wouldn't want a soldier on the ward at the same time as you'd have Taliban. So that all had to be quick, but then they needed to be sorted, and it all had to be really well thought out. But you can't always think about things when you're getting two or three casualties at the time, and they're going to theater, you don't know how long they're going to be on the ward before they can get casivacked out into like Kandahar or back to Birmingham. It was logistics wise it was quite difficult to get everybody. We had loads of kids that would come in,
civilians
who were caught up, in fighting. We had a range of everything. Women, so then we had to be careful because obviously Afghan women can't share a ward with Afghan men or any man. So if we had men, so it's just getting it completely right. And everyone, obviously safety for not only us, but for them, making sure there was enough staff to cover it.
You just mentioned Taliban, which is of course the people you're fighting, the regime. So you would have to treat soldiers that were effectively trying to kill British and American soldiers.
Yeah.
How did you find that?
So again, I think being so young, because I was 20 when I got sent to Afghan. Being so young, I think, we had to. There was no, it wasn't, and because I was in the army, we did what we're told. That is essentially like what happens. Someone tells you what to do, and you have to carry it out. And if you don't, then there's consequences. So for us, it was just something we had to do. There would always be, if any they were always suspected Taliban. We didn't ever obviously know. But they would always be guarded. So we'd always have a Marine or a soldier on the ward guarding them.
Guarding them from who?
So our safety,
Case they wanted to do something.
Yeah.
Or soldiers wanted to get to them, could that be?
Yeah, I'd say that's the other thing as well. Because then once they came to us, they were obviously coming to us to stabilize or whatever we needed to do, and then they'd get questioned. So I don't really know where they'd go from there, but then that's where they'd get questioned.
Did you ever was there any moments where you thought that was a lot, I've had to process there, or a day where you just thought, you walked away from going, what am I doing?
But at the time, I'd say no, I didn't. I just got on with it and I did what I had to do. Yeah, there was days that I missed being, I was 20. I loved going out. I loved partying. I had great friends and I missed all that. But the only time that I felt really threatened in any way, there was a couple of times, but the biggest one was we had two Afghan nationals on the ward. And we were looking after them, and the toilets were like the posh ones you get when you go to racing or something. And they're not quite Portaloos, they're a bit posher, but they were our toilets. And but we all kind of I think there was a male and a female. So the male would be used by patient staff, and then the female would be used by staff and patients. And one of the consultants or senior members went to the toilet, and they had to carry a pistol. So they had like a waistband carrier, and they carried pistol. I can't think why he had the pistol on him, because when we were working, we didn't have our weapons with us. They were in an armory. But he took the kind of holder. He must have taken it off to go to the toilet and forgot to put it back on.
Oh my God.
So the next person to use the toilet was an Afghan national, and he picked it up and put it under his pillow, but we didn't know. So the only reason we knew is because we had interpreters on the ward who would come and help us interpret everything. And he heard them talk amongst themselves to say that they had this under their pillow and managed to let us know. And then it all got sorted. There was absolutely no problem. But when I look back, I think that could have been so different. Like that, they could have, you know, done anything. And yeah, so they're like things like that. I look back and think, oh God, that could have been so different. But apart from that, not really. There was never, like, obviously the casualties that came in were heartbreaking at times. And
yeah, so what was you having been confronted with? What did you, say heartbreaking? What?
Yeah, a lot of it was, so what would happen is if we had any casualties coming in, if there was time for them to go to theatre, if it depended on how many casualties, obviously they'd be triaged. So they'd go through the A&E. You've got to imagine it was a tent. So it was a big long spine of this tent. And then so as you walk in, that was the A&E. And then along the spine, you had theatres on one side. You'd have like cleaning of equipment on the other side. Then you come down a bit more. Then you'd have the wards. And then, you know, there was different cells coming off the spine of the hospital. So basically we'd have recovery as well. So whoever was triaged as most needing any surgery, they would go to theatre first, and then we would keep like anybody that wasn't quite as urgent. So we'd have you probably have someone with shrapnel in their leg, like you're talking about your uncle, but not someone who'd had their leg kind of blown off, because they would have been in theatres, so we wouldn't have tended to see them. Because then what would happen, they'd go to recovery, and then from recovery they'd get CASEVAC'd by the RAF to either Kandahar, where they had a bigger purpose-built hospital, or Kabul, I think, or even Birmingham. They'd fly back to Birmingham and be treated there. So they'd get stabilised. So we were really like, we'd have a lot of the Afghan nationals who'd had surgery maybe. So like on a ward, post-op kind of surgery care is what we'd get. IV antibiotics and just monitoring them, really.
And I presume you felt like you were doing good. This was a good, you felt like you were contributing. Or is it
some days, yeah. So for the soldiers, our soldiers definitely, obviously. For the Afghan nationals, not always. The kids were really hard, because they aren't westernised. You know, they live in a desert, they're not a house. It was either what would you call them, a shack or a mud house kind of thing. There was no sanitation. I remember taking, I think she was about 3 or 4, and I remember, you know, they don't have nappies and things like that. So we had to be really careful what we introduced them to. And I remember taking one of the little girls to the toilet, and I helped her, I sat her on the toilet and she went, and then I flushed the chain. And I've never seen a child so scared in all my life.
Wow.
She literally was like, that noise, I can't really remember her experience or how traumatic it was, but just petrified of a flushing toilet, which we all take for granted, don't we, day in, day out. So, yeah, sometimes I think, you know, they loved it. They loved being on the ward and, you know, we had loads of things sent to us to entertain them, colouring books and things that, you know, they'd never have seen before.
Was this from the UK?
Yeah, just charities or, you know, family, because we didn't really realise, I don't think, we'd have so many kids on the ward. I don't think we had one paediatric nurse out with us who was TA, and that was it. I think even over time, it became much more apparent that we'd need more like paediatric kind of care.
These kids with injuries, or would it be?
Yeah.
From fighting?
Yeah.
they got caught up
yeah. in. Yeah. One little boy we had, he had, I think it must have been a gunshot wound to his leg. And he was in like a massive metal halo, like to try and fix his leg and crutches and everything. He was with us for a long time. We had like babies that were with us for like, how old were they? Like toddlers, one, 2 year olds. Yeah, we had quite.
And it never, you were always sort of philosophical. You could always just get through the day and wake up and do it again. It would never,
yeah. No,
but you know, I guess when you're young, you're resilient, aren't you? Really resilient.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I'd totally think differently now to what I would, what I did when I was that age. Definitely. What, no two ways about it.
When you said you've got to be careful what you expose the kids to, is it because you don't want them, what is it, you don't want to give them too much because they have to go back to normality? Or
yeah, pretty much, yeah, it was, that was it. They had to go back to living at home and with their parents and everything. So, yeah,
so
I remember.
So you can spoil them, essentially.
One little boy, he used to get like nightmares, not quite nightmares, but he used to talk a lot in his sleep. And do you know what he used to talk about? Crisps and chocolate. He just dreamt about, because obviously we would feed them, but we fed them from our cookhouse or our food that we eat.
Yeah.
And then part of that was like they'd have a packet of crisps at lunch and things like that. And they'd dream it. He'd shout about these crisps and chocolate. It's hilarious. But yeah, we just had to be really careful because they were going back to that kind of life, you know, that they weren't going to have things like that. And yeah, that, I just remember that really.
Yeah. How long was you on that, working in Afghanistan for?
6 months. So I did April, and then in the January I got 2 weeks off. They call it R&R. And then I went back and did 3 months, and I had my 21st birthday out there. And
how
came
did you
back
celebrate?
In April. Yeah, we did. Yeah, I remember we did.
Did you have alcohol out there?
We did have, they call it the toucan rule. So we had... I think I remember Kaiser Chiefs. They came out and did like a show for us. Catherine Jenkins came out and sang. So like when there was things like that, we were allowed two cans of beer. Yeah, 2 cans of beer or cider. I think you could choose cider instead.
How do they they just ration it, or do you have to,
I think you either got given the 2 cans, or you got like tickets. So like your command above will give you like the tickets, and then you'd cash them in, kind of thing.
You're in the middle of Afghanistan. You're seeing these, what most people would consider to be horrendous things. You know, kids with injuries, gunshot wounds. Mm. As you said, the kid who needed the halos, that means his leg was significantly damaged.
Yeah.
You're seeing soldiers coming in, dealing with what they're seeing out there. You've got a Taliban or an Afghan national who's managed to smuggle or find a gun in, like, that's a lot, right? But in the middle of all that, you managed to fall in love as well.
I did, yeah.
How did that happen? Who falls in love in Afghanistan?
I know, it is crazy. But before we went to Afghanistan, I went on pre-deployment training to York, and I saw this... this Marine, like, I'd never known Marines, I didn't know what they were, but I just saw him and I thought, oh my God, he looks like Jason Statham. and that was it. I didn't, like, we kind of didn't, I don't remember talking to him, nothing. And then, I don't know, he must have remembered me and I remembered him, but I was in the gym. I think I'd just got out there a couple of weeks before him, and I was on the bike in the gym, and I had my, I think I had like a iPod. Is that what they were called? You know, with the music on.
Yeah, back in the day.
I had one of them and my music on and the headphones on. And he came in and he waved. And I was like, I'd already probably gone bright red from working out and also seeing him. And I thought, who's he waving at? So I just ignored him. Anyway, he walked out and I looked behind me, thinking like he'd waved someone, and nobody was behind me. He was literally waving to me. And I totally mugged him off.
You had mugged him off.
Yeah, totally. So then I felt, well, that was it. I was beside myself and I was like, God, I need, next time I see him, I'm going to have to apologize. So I did see him and as like I said, I'm really, really sorry. I didn't realize you're waving at me. Like, why don't you come and help? And this is mortifying every time I say it, but I was like, why don't you come and help me clean my weapon? Because obviously being in the sandy desert, we had to clean our weapons quite a lot. And I was rubbish. Like that was the worst
thing. Oh, you did need, like, you genuinely needed help with your weapon?
Genuinely needed help. I mean, it was a bit cheesy. And no, looking back, I was like, oh.
I like that. I know what you're like. I've got a really like, dirty gun. Yeah. And I know what you're going to enjoy. You're going to enjoy coming and help me clean it. Okay? Let me make this up to you.
It worked. So we just met in the nappy, which was, the nappy is like your place of where you hang out, really. And you get, like, it's a shop. And they sell cans of pop and crisps and chocolate. Mm. It was always running out of stuff. But yeah, sometimes it'd be good and you could just sit on benches outside and catch up with people. And for the lads that have been like in the, like the different places, it was nice for them to have a bit of normality. But yeah, he was pretty much on the, in camp with me all the time, but he did have to go out as well. So
you started a relationship there, would you say? And like,
I was always, if I'm saying how long we've been together, I was counting from October 2004.
And him being a Marine, I know you mentioned him being like quite private, so I don't want to go into too much detail, but him being a Marine would mean that he would probably be involved in the more challenging missions for the soldiers.
Definitely.
Because the Marine, what level is the Marine at? Is he, if you mentioned the phone, it's like one below sort of special forces, SAS.
And it's like your elite kind of infantry, and that's not taking anything away from like infantry soldiers, but it is like an elite club kind of thing. Yeah. And the training is like really hard, and yeah, it's very difficult. And yeah, he did have to go out. He'd been to Iraq actually before. So he'd done a bit, but it was certainly different, I think. But any time we could get together, you know, just catching up. There was also like what they called a welfare tent. So they would have like board games in there and a telly, but you couldn't watch telly. It was all DVDs. So they'd have like DVDs to watch and stuff.
Yeah.
We just used to meet in there So we just, but it was, do you know what? It's lovely because we just got to know each other for like 3 months. So it was just talking and we really knew everything about each other. And then on my R&R, so in the January, he finished his tour and he'd got home. We timed it. So he got his time off at pretty much the same time. So we managed to have a bit of normality in between it all, which was lovely.
You were allowed to have a relationship in the army with other soldiers?
Yeah. You can have a relationship, but you can't be, they call it fraternizing. So you can't be fraternizing in public. And we certainly didn't. Like, it was nothing seedy, or we weren't like sneaking off for snogs or anything like that. It was really quite quite sweet, really, when I look back. It was just genuinely just getting to know each other. And we knew everything, I suppose, about each other by the time we'd, you know, managed to have private time away from it all.
Was it part of your, the fact that you was in a relationship and you could see a future together that you thought maybe you'd need to leave the army? Or was that part of your reasoning?
Yeah, so I got back April. And yeah, definitely the relationship was a big key factor because I was based in Aldershot still, with the view of getting posted, I think, to somewhere else, which could have been like Northallerton, it could have been Birmingham.
Yeah.
So one of us had to give. And by this point, because I hadn't done I wasn't a trained nurse, I was like, I'm just going to apply for universities now and do my nurse training. Like, I'm ready. I couldn't do it through the army because I'd already done 4 years, 4.5 years. And I was a Lance Corporal, so I'd got a rank, and if I'd gone to do my nurse training, I would have been a Lance Corporal doing 3 years nurse training. Then once I'd qualified, I'd only have gone up to corporal, and then you're time barred for 3 years. It's something to do with the pay, I think. So then you're time barred, and it was just time. That would have been like, what, 10 years, 11 years of a corporal. And by that point, you want to be, you know, sergeant. It's all about the pay, really.
Right.
Well,
that's what I was going to say. Who cares if whether you're in a corporate or lance corporal or what does it matter?
Yeah.
You mentioned
pay system scale.
Yeah, it's like bands in the NHS, right?
Yeah, that's it, yeah.
You said something interesting the other day when we spoke, that that you had to be a senior or have a rank above the soldiers you were treating. Is that correct?
Yeah. So with nursing, that's the reason you get given, my understanding of it was that you get given the corporal, because you have to, like, if you're treating patients, they're going to, I mean, you could be treating a sergeant, but you're still only, which is one above like a corporal, but you've still got a rank. So when you're telling someone you must take your tablets or you must do your exercises, that's why they give you that. You pass out basically from your nurse training as a corporal.
So you follow rank, that's the way.
Yeah, then you're time barred for 3 years, but then you could get sergeant quite quickly or staff sergeant, you know, then there's no stopping you really. You could go on.
As a nurse, honest, staff sergeant as a nurse?
Yeah, like warrant, they were the scariest. They were like, you don't mess with them at all. You literally,
these are what do you call them in normal hospitals or wards?
Matrons.
Yeah, is it like that?
Yeah, I'd say they were. Like they, I would say they were definitely. You just didn't mess with them. Like what they were old school, like really old school. And what, you know, they didn't know wasn't worth knowing. They were really like in terms of military. You've got to remember, most of them would have, because it wasn't too long before I joined that they'd shut down all the military hospitals. So a lot of them would have like worked in the military hospitals, and it must have been really hard for them, like integrating with the civvies and the NHS. And but it was great. I loved it. I absolutely loved every part of it. And I always say it was the best thing I ever did joining. But for me at that time, it was the best thing I ever did was leaving as well, because I'm now a qualified nurse. And yeah, it's
good.
Great.
Well, this has been fascinating. I know you was worried about it not being like you. Asking whether people would want to listen to it, but I'm sure they will, because it is really interesting. And you know, these podcasts, the No Holds Barred podcast, these interviews that we're doing, is it's that everybody has an interesting story. Everybody has a story, and you know, just getting through to, or finding a way to tell that is often, you know, a very interesting thing for other people to listen. So it's been really, really fascinating for me. And you're still together with your husband. You've got two lovely boys.
Yeah, we're still together. We're not married, which surprises everybody, but we're still not married. But you know what? Yeah, we're happy as we are. And yeah, I suppose for us now, it's cementing the name, I suppose, for the boys. Mm. But yeah, no, we're still together, still really happy.
Fantastic.
Still have loads of fun. So yeah,
and
it's...
Partner. did your partner... did he leave the army or did he remain in?
Yeah, so he left. He once I put my notice in, because the thing is, once you put your notice in, you have to give a year's notice.
Oh wow!
So it's not like 4 weeks or anything. Like you have.
No,
to
I suppose because they've got a plan ahead, haven't they? If there's like wars that are going to be fighting, they've got like, I'll just give my 2 week notice, I'm out of it.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I did my year's notice, and then I start uni. I think I was just starting uni as he was leaving, and it was hard, really tough for him, I'd say. For me, it was really, the transition was really easy, because I was 17 and when I joined, and I was 22 when I left. But for him, he was 25 when he joined the Marines, and 29 when he left, so we only did 4 years. But that transition was quite hard to
from
get
army,
back into
army to normality, to civilian,
to get back
life.
Into civvy life, and I have to say that is probably so common for most people that leave the army or the Marines or any forces, is because you're so
It's a lifestyle.
Institutionalized. Yeah. Like you like yeah. I said earlier, if a rank tells you you have to do something, you do it. You know, there's no getting away from it. And so you kind of, it's hard to then carry that through. And especially if you have been a rank or you've been that one, you know, it's hard, definitely.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's, we're happy. And again, I think he always says, once you're a Marine, you're always a Marine. And I totally get that. And I just hope my boys don't join, which yeah. I know sounds awful, but I think we were saying earlier, weren't we, about how like I had no fear then, but yeah. I'm a mum now and I've got yeah. two boys, and the thought of them joining, yeah, sends the fear of God into me, really. But
yeah, and yeah, it's tough, isn't it? Because their dad being like essentially a real life Jason Statham is yeah. actually, he's going to, you know, they're going to want to grow up to be like him. But, you know, well.
It is. And that is the thing that drives me insane, because he'll go, like the boys especially, they'll go, yeah, my dad was in the Marines. And I'm like, and yeah, mum was in the army. And they're like, they just forget about me all the time. They literally, it's just daddy was in the Marines. They never highlight that I was in the army, which is quite interesting.
Well, yeah, I guess it's the stuff you see on television, isn't it? It's like it's the soldiers and
just bypass me. I'm just a nurse now.
Though. Yeah, you just got to remind them every
just
now.
Just
to
have a boring lifestyle.
Emily, it's been fantastic talking to you. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks so much, Fab. Really appreciate it.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.